comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thanks for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. It is talk radio like nowhere else on Earth, and I'm here because it matters, and so do you. Don't forget, if you have already heard about this and you haven't done it, subscribe to the K-Files. It's our free weekly newsletter. If you are brand new to the show, this is the first time you're hearing about it, so subscribe. It's absolutely free. You just go over to our website, kevinsmithshow.com, look for the link that says K-Files, click it, and subscribe. You can unsubscribe anytime you want to. Well, I'll tell you what, the Earth is giving a whole new definition to the term rock and roll. There was another earthquake in Chile this morning, setting off another tsunami warning. There was a 6.4 magnitude earthquake in Taiwan at 4:18 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Our local time for the show, Pacific Standard Time, at 4:18 p.m. And then in Chile, again, a 6.1 earthquake at 5:59 p.m. In Bataan Islands, the Philippines, at 6:08 p.m., just less than an hour ago, there was a 4.7 earthquake. I'll tell you, folks, it's rocking and rolling. And there have been 373 earthquakes in the last 7 days. 373. It's been an active day today, the past 24 hours, less than 24 hours. There have been earthquakes all around, and I've shared some of them with you here this evening. I've been getting email from people about the, you remember when Walter Bosley was on and we talked about a source that passed to him. I called it a prediction. The source calls it a calculated estimate. He estimated that it was going to happen. He estimated that it was going to be intense. He estimated that it would be in Northern California. Well, he missed the location, although I think he's probably convinced that's still going to happen. But the fact of the earthquakes and most of the major stuff being on this side of the planet, some of the email I'm getting is saying that's close enough for me. The guy was onto something there. And I've talked with Walter. And he's going to be coming on and sharing with us next week. We're going to open the envelope that we showed everyone. I'm going to read what's in the envelope. And one person said, well, you know, maybe he just needs to tweak his algorithm by which he made this calculated estimate. Just tweak it a little bit. Well, maybe. I don't know. We're going to look at it, though. He'll be on next week, Walter will, and we'll open the envelope and we'll talk about it. Tonight, Robert Morningstar. We'll be back. Welcome back. My guest this evening is Robert Morningstar, known to most of you as editor of something called UFO Digest. It's really a major site with major resources for those who are interested in the whole topic of UFOs. There are other articles of another nature on there, but its focus is UFOs. And I'm delighted to have him back with us this evening. Robert, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Kevin. It's always a pleasure to speak to you.
You've had a pretty busy day.
New York is a pretty busy place. Yeah.
Well, it's been a pretty busy day all around the world. In right at the top of the show, I was talking about all these earthquakes.
Right.
And, you know, just today, although this is not what we're really going to talk about, I'll throw this to you and see if you have a comment on it.
Okay.
But just today, we started off with an earthquake in Chile, 6.0, I think. Anyway, it set off another tsunami alert, and then this afternoon, and I've got this in Pacific Standard Time now, so everyone can convert to their own time zone. But at 4:18 p.m., there was a 6.4 earthquake in Taiwan. Then at 5:59. A little over an hour ago, we had Chile with another 6.1.
Mm-hmm.
And then at 6:08 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, a 4.7 in the Philippines, a total of 373 earthquakes in the last 7 days.
Right. The Ring of Fire is really cranking up. And a lot of people don't think, you know, some people don't think that this is a natural occurrence and that it's, well, may I be so blunt as to say,
sure,
some people think that there's an earthquake war going on with people who are using scalar technologies. And there's something really strange about the first quake over the weekend in Chile, in that it was the most powerful one in years, and it ranks among the top 10 at 8.8.
Mm-hmm.
Some people said 9. And that the power of this was staggering and sent off a tsunami. And this tsunami was expected to overrun coastlines, and it just, as I put it to Richard Hoagland, what happened? This thing just dribbled by Hawaii. Where did all the energy go? So there's something very unusual going around, going down with the geophysics of this. The fact that the Chile earthquake was so powerful that it has shortened the day by 1.23 millionths of a second, it's also very significant. For those who follow things like prophecy, one of the things that's said about end times is that the days will be shortened. And what's curious is that both the Indonesian earthquake of 2004-2005, that Christmas to New Year's,
mm-hmm,
and this one in Chile have both shortened the days.
Mm-hmm.
So I just proffer that as a synchronicity.
Well, you know, I got an email from one of our regular listeners. When I say one of our regular, all of our listeners are regular, but you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, some are more regular than others.
Well, one of our frequent listeners.
Yeah,
and a great supporter of the show, and she said that she had friends or relatives. I've read so many emails today, I can't remember all the details, but they were in Chile when I don't know which of the earthquakes, maybe it was the first one, or maybe it's one of the subsequent earthquakes that have happened since then, but they said that there was fog. They were in a place where they just never have fog, and that the night before the earthquake, there was just this strange fog that settled in. All the dogs were absolutely quiet, and they normally bark at in the nighttime, and they were absolutely quiet. And the only sound was the sound of some birds.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And
sorry to interrupt, but
I just wanted to ask a question because I don't know this. Mm-hmm. I've read somewhere that fog can be a byproduct of the use of HAARP technology.
Yes, but it is also there are various forms of fog. Some of it has to do with differences in air temperature, cold air overrunning hot ground, or I should say warm air overrunning hot ground. But there's another kind of fog that's precipitated by rapid pressure changes. So high pressure in the atmosphere will be clear air, clear atmosphere, no clouds, no rain. As if the pressure drops very rapidly, there's condensation, and there is, in my interpretation of what you described to me, I would say that that would probably be due either to, probably to a rapid pressure change as the earthquake was winding up. Sorry I interrupted you, but mm-hmm. I've heard that those accounts about the quietness and stillness of animals in the days and hours before an earthquake strikes. I heard remarkable stories when I interviewed people. I went to Nicaragua in 1976 and I interviewed people about the earthquake that had happened in 72-73. There was a lot of UFO activity involved in that, and they said the same thing. The jungles around Managua came to absolute standstill. Yet, days before, this is the day before and the day of the earthquake, absolute stillness. I heard this from so many people. They repeated the same phrase, saying there was a sense of great sadness. Everyone was depressed. It was a very sad day, and this is before, and this is Christmas time, and before the earthquake hit. Yet, the 3 days before that, the jungles were alive with animal migrations, reaches of all kinds of monkeys and birds flying. So animals are very, very attuned to this. Another thing that people can look to as possible indicators of earthquakes is that radon levels in wells start to spike. They start to rise very quickly because apparently the earthquake upwelling is releasing radon gas, which seeps up and leaks into wells and under houses, but it can be measured in water. And that's one of the ways that earthquake activity or probability is being currently measured in certain places by measuring radon levels in wells.
Now, I'll tell you, I've lived in a jungle. Mm-hmm. I didn't just visit. I've lived there for 2 years. And if you want to go someplace where there's peace and quiet, you don't go to the jungle.
Right.
It is busy. There's a lot of busy stuff happening in the jungle. And lots of animals, lots of movement, lots of calls. And so if it goes quiet, you really got to figure something's up.
Yes, exactly. Which, if I may lend a story, I traveled to the rainforest of Puerto Rico in, I guess it was around 1973. No, it was much later. It was actually in the later 70s. Be that as it may, it was exactly 78. And my friend and I drove for hours and hours and hours trying to get into El Yunque and the rainforest. And we took the highways and the byways and then made our way up into the primeval, primordial rainforest. We drove into it, and then we found an opening and we parked there. And we stopped for a few minutes, and we stepped out. My friend went over to meditate someplace. I went over and walked around, and it was so still. I could not believe it. I did Tai Chi, and as I was doing Tai Chi in the jungle, I had this feeling that something was watching. And it, the strangeness of it, that not a single bird, not a peep, it seemed like not even an insect was around. And yet I had this feeling that I was being scrutinized. And it was shortly thereafter that the strange chupacabra activities started up down there in that region of Puerto Rico.
Well, now, I'll tell you something. People can laugh at this. Mm. And, you know, but it's the truth. I've been there. I know. When you walk into the jungle, you're the new kid on the block.
Mm.
And it wouldn't be unusual.
For some of them.
Yeah. Well, it would not be unusual for everything to go quiet for a little bit. As they all scrutinize you. But it shouldn't last for very long. Once they're accustomed to you being there, they just go on with business as usual.
There. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the encounters with, like we're talking about is cryptozoology,
mm-hmm.
the term that has been given to these strange, you know, apparitions of strange animals from Mothman to Bigfoot.
Mm-hmm.
And the Bigfoot lore and UFOs, I don't know if a lot of people are aware that Bigfoot and UFOs are associated. There's often UFO activity where Bigfoot has been seen. I received a very interesting Bigfoot story from an eyewitness. This is a very highly educated man who works in the aerospace industry. And he invented a machine that could find gold. So they went off prospecting in one of the southern states. And he was with two fellows who were actually government employees, you know,
mm-hmm.
badge-carrying hardware, like being guns and stuff
mm-hmm.
in the woods. And all of a sudden, as they were exploring this area where he thought they had the prospect of finding veins of gold using this equipment, Bigfoot popped out 75 feet away. And what he related to me was that it was such a strange encounter. They went into an altered state of awareness. The policeman jumped into action. They'd been, you know, Vietnam vets and whatnot, and you know they had their reactions. And they drew their weapons and they saw the creature. The creature stepped out, and then ambled away very gracefully into the woods, and the fellow was saying this thing was 8 feet tall, and he couldn't believe with what ease and grace this thing just went off like it didn't weigh anything.
Mm-hmm.
And what the policeman said was like, hey man, we've been set up. We were dead men. Something happened here. You know, that thing made sure that we saw it. You know, that thing wasn't trying to hide. It was drawing our attention. And they were very disturbed by the experience and hightailed it out of there. But for hours afterwards, the Vietnam vets felt like they had been ambushed. They'd been had. And even though they drew their guns, they knew if something had been happening, they would have, as we say, the other fellows had the drop on them.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an intentional manifestation. He stepped out to be seen and draw their attention, and now that what they're wondering is, what did we miss?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
You gotta wonder.
He wanted us to see it, and in doing it, distracted us from what the heck went on, you know? And that left them quite rattled. We're about to publish a Bigfoot story that comes from New Hampshire. A former MUFON investigator up there came across some remarkable tracks outside his house, and they didn't follow up with anything except a track on his roof. So he was a little bit upset about what that implied, you know, because it could only have stepped down from his roof and then up into the sky, or from the ground up onto the roof and up into the sky, because there were no tracks. I said, why didn't you follow the tracks? Said, there were no tracks to follow. It was just those few imprints.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to publish that very soon. While I'm on it, on the subject of what we're going to publish, I would like to say hello to Dirk Vanderploeg, our publisher, webmaster. Mm-hmm. He's recovering from surgery, and things have been slow at UFO Digest while he went through a procedure. And I just want to wish him the best and tell
Absolutely.
Our listeners that we're thinking of him, and I really appreciate him as a friend and colleague.
Well, and the same message from the Kevin Smith Show. I didn't know he'd been in the hospital.
Yeah, well, we kept it quiet until we knew we'd had a very good and positive resolution. So he's recovering now, and we're getting back to cranking out the stories. I've been editing a lot of really fine work, some of it by my friend Vince White, who was with MUFON in Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a very eloquent poet-philosopher of ufology. So we have something coming from Vince White. Actually, it's a homage to Coast to Coast. I don't know if they're your rivals. I think they're on really late.
But no, we're not rivals. They do their show and I do mine. I don't pay attention to them, and I'm pretty sure they don't pay attention to me.
But anyway, he cites them for having brought this kind of discussion into the mainstream with respectful moderators and interviewers.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're publishing that on his behalf.
You know, speaking of this type of story, we're talking about Bigfoot.
Mm-hmm.
I get a lot of requests. I get a few every month where people want me to do some shows on more shows on Bigfoot. One of the problems that I run into is no new information.
Well, I'm surprised because it seems to me that I've been getting, over the last couple of years, I've been getting a lot of information. And particularly, you know, almost everyone associates Bigfoot with the Great Northwest. But most of the Bigfoot reports that I've been getting recently come from the central states and, in fact, Pennsylvania, upstate New York. As a matter of fact.
Well, yeah, they're new reports, but it's kind of like we go through periods of time like this with UFOs where there are reports, but it's reports of lights in the sky. Okay.
Yeah, it's sporadic. You know. I understand.
And okay, you saw some lights in the sky, you know? Okay. Mm-hmm. And with Bigfoot, we're going through a period right now where it seems like all the reports are we found some footprints. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but
some people in Pennsylvania put out some interesting photographs that had been taken by night vision cameras.
Okay, we have to step away for break. I want to hear about those when we come back. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Okay, we were talking with Robert Morningstar about the Bigfoot reports, and Robert, you said that there had been some interesting photographs with night vision equipment taken from Pennsylvania.
Yeah, and these came in Bucks County, that area in Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh.
They came out last summer and early, meaning 2009, spring and into summer of 2009, and there were some rather unusual forms captured, not bears, you know,
mm-hmm.
much longer legs than bears, completely covered with hair. The Bigfoot phenomenon to me is very curious, and I wonder, you know, this is just a hypothesis, I wonder if it is possible that some ancient strain of Neanderthal could have evolved and survived and just branched off and gone off, as we say, into the woods.
Well, I think that's possible, but I'm going to tell you something that's really far out.
What's that?
There is the possibility that the Wookiee in Star Wars is not fictional.
You're a mind reader. That's what I was going to bring out.
Yeah, that Chewbacca may be for real.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's amazing, Kevin. Should I bring out the fact that the Wookiee is a Bigfoot in Star Wars? And
well, you know, it's amazing. A Kevin Smith show. We go to the edge.
Yeah, absolutely. You know what's funny? I was in England. I never understood, like, the origin of that concept, but I was going through one of these small English towns in near Stonehenge, and turned a place. You know how they have all these little ins, alleys, courts?
Mm-hmm.
And there was this place called Wookie Corner.
Hmm.
And so the Wookie is apparently some kind of a legend from England and Europe, which is kind of like maybe their Bigfoot.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of strange. So I was always wondering where the heck that word came from. But
well,
it's obvious, you know.
Until just this moment, I had no idea.
Arms out of people's shoulders when they lose chess, you know. That was mm-hmm. a pretty funny line there.
Well, until just this moment, I had no idea that that was part of English lore.
Lore.
Mm-hmm. There. Had no idea. But, you know, there are things that we've seen in science fiction movies that have materialized in reality,
yeah,
so accurately that it leads people to think, and I've had people express it on this show, that they think that sometimes these science fiction movies had some inside information.
Well,
and
you sure.
know, maybe they did.
You want to go really a blast from the past and go way back?
Okay.
Let's go back to Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Okay.
And the story that devolves in around UFOs around Los Angeles. And as the story goes, UFOs are snatching people in Los Angeles and stealing their souls and making them into zombies. And there are these extraterrestrials that are like a cross between like this kind of brute, bald-headed monster played by Tor Johnson. And he's remarkably like a Soviet automaton. And the other group is Vampyra and Bela Lugosi as the vampires, who are like really literally soul-sucking.
Mm-hmm.
That was Lugosi's last movie, and I saw it several times. I paid 25 cents as a kid, you know, after school, running into the one theater that would let kids in alone between 3 and 3:15. And I thought, this is a really strange movie. And it's trying to say something, but it's a really weird one, you know, for like I was 11 years old, maybe. So years later, I come across some purported film of Roswell, and it showed a very unusual extraterrestrial who looked like none other than Tor Johnson, as he looked in that movie. So then the movie Ed Wood comes out and tells the story of how that movie was produced. And it turns out that a group of Southern Baptists who had a script funded the movie and got Ed Wood to make it. And they wanted it really specifically to tell this story and bring it to the public in this really low-budget, super low-budget, now classic science fiction film. But basically, this group of Southern Baptists were very, very interested in getting out to the public the dangers, the spiritual dangers of encounters with UFOs, and that they were actually soul-snatching, and that was their purpose on Earth.
Hmm.
I think that's one of the best movies I've seen as far as comedy is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was that point. There's a point in the movie where I just forgot that Martin Landau was Martin Landau. And he really deserved the Academy Award for that performance as Lugosi. But
well, you know, it's pretty odd. And I'm trying to remember now what the name of the comic was, but it was a comic book character. It's on Hoagland's site, Richard Hoagland's site.
Yeah.
But it's a science fiction comic book character. And but in the illustration, when he goes to Mars, there is a face on Mars, and this was long before we had sent a satellite to take a picture of it.
Right. Maybe it's a memory. You know, sometimes I think that these things that we call imagination. Well, you know my saying on my logo. I say there's a saying that says, to think is to create, imagination becomes reality. Mm-hmm. That's an old saying of Tai Chi masters I learned from a master named T.T. Liang. It's kind of like, be careful what you wish for because you just might get it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering if these quantum leaps of imagination are actually upwellings of memories that are encoded in our DNA. Because I know for certain that there have been moments, critical moments in my life, where this energy surged through my body to save me from a perceived danger. And I realized that the reaction I was exhibiting, that this thing had control of me, it was beyond my ego. Something wanted me and loved me so much that it wanted to keep me alive beyond my ego's comprehension or ability to control my body. It's like, mm-hmm. Like jumping 10 feet. That's not what I did. I flipped backwards to escape what I thought was an attack by a giant spider. But it was kind of a peripheral perception that initiated a huge reaction. And as it was happening to me, what I would call I recalled was that this was a reaction of a caveman ancestor who had jumped backward out of some primordial cave when some giant insect lurched at him, and that this was such a life-altering experience that it became encoded as a survival instinct in all of his subsequent descendants, including me.
Well, you know something? I haven't remembered something consciously,
mm-hmm.
Like what you're describing. But I had a weird thing happen to me a number of years ago. You remember, it was the Pope before, you had John Paul, and then before him there was one that was a Pope for a short period of time.
John Paul I.
Yeah, and then you had before him John the 23rd, remember?
Before that was Pius the 6th.
Well, which one was...
Well, Paul the Sixth, and then John the 23rd.
There we go, John the 23rd. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, now John the 23rd.
Yeah.
So I was pretty young, but I woke up early in the morning, and I was awakened by the television being on, which was pretty unusual. And there was a news report playing, and they were reporting that he had died.
That would be John Paul when the 23rd
mm-hmm.
died. He died the same year as President Kennedy, 1963.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he didn't actually die until the next week.
Hmm.
But I saw the news report at 2 o'clock and 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
On the TV in my bedroom, I saw the news report that said he had died.
Well, that's called precognition, you know?
Well, it was on the TV.
But was it...
Wasn't a dream.
It wasn't a dream.
No.
Well,
was not a dream.
Uh-huh.
I was wide awake.
Something like that, but it was definitely a dream. And
yeah.
It's similar in nature. And this happened to me in about 1957, 58. There were several Titanic movies that were made in the 50s, and A Night to Remember was made around 57, I believe. So Titanic was in my mind, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I had this amazingly vivid dream that I was watching television and that Walter Cronkite announced that the Titanic had been found off the coast of Ireland. It was so vivid. It was. I will never forget it. And this was 1958. And then in the 1980s, all of a sudden, Bob Ballard finds it. And then I'm watching television and Walter Cronkite saying, you know, the Titanic has been found at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. So those are things, you know, that go in my book under precognition. You know, the soul is free to travel both forward and backward in time. It's not limited by the weight of the body.
Well, my soul watches television.
Viewing. Yeah, but yeah, that's unique. There's a name for that, mediumship through electronic media.
Yeah, I was definitely awake. I was definitely in my room, and I was definitely watching the television was on. Mm-hmm. The television is what woke me up.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very unusual. I didn't normally go to sleep with the television on. And I don't recall going to sleep with the television on, but it was on. And I woke up, and you know, there were all of these, you know how it is when somebody important dies, all these reports and people talking about the impact of it, and talking about the selection of a new pope and how that all happens. All that was on. But mm-hmm. when the sun came up, John the 23rd was still alive. But the next week, uh-huh. he died.
Yeah. How did you feel about that? How did do you recall?
I was confused.
Being puzzled by it, or
I actually had a conversation with my parents at breakfast, and told them. I said, you know, I woke up during the night. The news was on. They said the Pope died, mm-hmm. and my dad was sitting there with the morning newspaper having coffee. He said, well, that's odd. There's nothing about it in the newspaper. Mm-hmm. And I was a little confused about that. And as the morning wore on, I became aware of the fact that he had not died. And it was a little confusing. But I thought, well, I don't know. What can I say? You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, great events release. There's a kind of a psychic discharge that is released in these moments, high moments in history. For example, the death of John F. Kennedy was such a catastrophic event and a traumatic event, and the upwelling of feelings and the tearing of emotions that occurred at that event.
We have to step away for a break, Robert, so we will pick up there when we come back. Don't go away, folks. More with Robert Morningstar. Talking with Robert Morningstar. Robert, we got cut off right in the middle of you talking about some psychic things that happened concomitant with the assassination of President Kennedy.
I'm saying that, you know, there is something called the group soul, right? There's something called the collective unconscious. And events like President Kennedy's assassination, which are so traumatic on a worldwide scale, there's an emotional discharge that erupts and is released. And, I mean, I can give you countless examples, like, you know, from being distraught, and women who just were lost all faith in the world, cut their hair. But Jean Dixon, famous psychic, was picking up these vibrations in the months before the president was assassinated. And she saw the White House with these glowing clouds lowering, getting worse and worse, and a black cloud forming, and then the black cloud overrunning the entire White House, and then the White House festooned with mournful, dark, mournful colors. And she felt that it was coming, but there was nothing. And she tried to warn the White House, because she did have access to the White House. She also saw the New York blackout of 1965 a month before it happened, and she did it live on the Johnny Carson show. She was brought in as a guest, and as she sat down, she relates that she saw all the studio lights go out, everything went black, and she predicted that something from space was going to cause blackouts, vast blackouts in our country. And a month later, the great blackout of the Northeast occurred, which is related to UFOs in that some kid and some other witnesses up in Niagara Falls saw a UFO hovering around a power station in the moments immediately before everything went out. And a famous photograph came out, and I recall it very vividly. It was practically a full moon night that night in November of 1965 of the first great blackout. And the following day in the Daily News, in the centerpiece across two pages of newspaper, was this huge photograph. If anyone could find it, I would really appreciate a copy of this. But there it was, taken from New Jersey, with the silhouette of New York City visible because of the full moonlight shining behind it, and there in the sky, a huge UFO overflying the city. So,
I have not seen that one.
Gene Dixon. Yeah, it's, well, it's the next day, whatever, what was it, November 4th or 5th, 1965. And this is why the Kecksburg experience was so disturbing to President Johnson, because all of this stuff was happening, and then in December, a month after the blackout, this thing drops out of nowhere into Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, and we still haven't gotten to the bottom of it.
But yeah, I think they claim they've lost all the records on that now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. A nice, pretty easy excuse.
Let's change directions just a moment. I want to ask you about something. We've had as guest on this show, and he's going to be back on this show, someone that sort of set the world rocking. His name is Aaron McCollum.
Yeah.
And Aaron kind of set the world rocking by coming out and talking about having been trained as what we refer to as a super soldier.
Mm-hmm.
And also with his interview on Project Camelot, where he talks about having gotten information from various people that a Stargate had opened up. It's in the water off the coast of Yemen. And he said that it began to open up on January the 5th.
Right.
And that there were a bunch of ships around it.
Right.
From bunches of nations. So the fact that you're saying yes and right means you're familiar with Aaron McCollum and his story. What's your take on it? What's your take on that?
Well, I was very impressed by that interview. Kerry Cassidy and Project Camelot do a lot of good interviews. They seem, they have no agenda. They let the person speak their heart and tell you the truth as they know it or believe it. And this was an exceptionally good interview. And because of the background information that I have, I too, and you and I both have sources in the military and in, all over the world.
Yeah.
But my own background, if you'll go back to our program on mind control a mm-hmm. bunch of months ago, maybe mm-hmm. the end of last year, where we talked about experiments that I was involved with to develop artificial intelligence and that kind of thing. I was fascinated by Aaron McCollum's account of the training that he had gone through, and touching back on the testimony of Duncan O'Fionnan, whose testimony I also hold in high regard dealing with the training and the use of drugs, the use of, and basically I think I said to you that it looks like Duncan O'Fionnan experienced the real 3D technology used on him 10 years before it came out in Avatar. Now, I have quipped for quite a while that I believe that what the artificial intelligence program did for me or to me is to give me something akin to the mind of the dolphin. And I was amazed by McCollum's account of the use of dolphins in this work that he was involved in. I was amazed at the insinuation. There's supposed to be a second interview in more detail about this, but he intimated or insinuated that the United States Navy had injected him with dolphin DNA in order to alter his makeup, and it's not making him a super soldier, but a super sailor,
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking forward with great interest to this second interview with him. because I believe that since the early 1960s, late 1950s actually, I became aware of this around 1961, of the Dolphin, the Mind of the Dolphin project run the United States Navy by Dr. John Lilly. And I was completely fascinated with it and his ability to communicate with Ina and to teach it some aspects of language. I heard a dolphin say, "Ina, love Dr. Lilly."
Really?
I'm believing the film does exist. But this experiment in interspecies communication is one of the most important experiments in the history of mankind. Because under this cover of communicating with a dolphin, protocols were being developed for in anticipation of having to communicate with an extraterrestrial. You might say that since a dolphin doesn't live on Earth, on land, on Terra, he's extra Terra, you know? He's
yeah.
a marine mammal. So this work was very important on both levels. Plus, not only interspecies communication, possibly laying protocols for communicating with extraterrestrials that we might encounter or may have already encountered, to develop higher level intelligence in human beings. I believe that McCollum's story and the part of his story was that the United States Navy uses dolphins as shamans or mediums to help boost a human portals through which they can travel or engage in communications with extraterrestrials.
Now, why would the Navy be using dolphins instead of human mediums?
Well, he said that the physical vibration of the dolphin, his, let's call it his resonance, when, let's make an analogy with tuning forks, that the tuning fork of a dolphin is more highly tuned, attuned to these hyperdimensional realities, and that the human being at a lower tone, when put in the proximity of a dolphin, the dolphin's tune, his frequency, will resonate and alter, bring into...
Okay, Robert, we have to step away for break. We'll be back, folks, right after this, so don't go away.
Gene Simmons would want to be if he could be a talk host. Here's Kevin.
And we are back. And let me welcome those of you who are joining us just now in this second hour. We're talking with Robert Morningstar, editor at UFO Digest. And he's written quite extensively himself, so some of you have read some of his writings, particularly, I know you have, because of our discussion about the JFK assassination and the show that we did about that, and we linked to that to the webpage where you could read that. But Robert, you were talking about the dolphins. I had asked the question, why this story about the U.S. Navy using dolphins as kind of mediums or shamans to open portals?
So,
and so why that instead of humans?
Well, as I said, it has something to do with resonance and being able to find the right octave to be in harmony with the vibration of this portal. And let me just see how I can describe this. Let's say if you increase this resonant frequency of the human body, the molecular structure is altered, facilitating passage. Analogy, UFO abductions. The UFO manifests, something comes through, some blue light. Some people describe it as having this blue light permeates them, which makes it possible for them to move. They feel like they're no longer solid. They're kind of like a gel. And that they move through this gel and are drawn through this gel right through solid walls and into the spacecraft where the abduction occurs. Mm-hmm. So the analogy I use with the tuning fork is that the human's tuning fork is not well tuned, but in the presence of the perfect pitch of the dolphin's vibration in this pool of water, as I understand McCollum describing it, because the water transmits this vibration more directly than being in air, it brings the human into alignment or tunes them up or tunes the human being and alters his molecular structure to facilitate passage through what McCollum described as a stargate or a portal. Now, this thing that's happening, I heard rumors of it beginning, right after the beginning of the year, something strange is happening in the Gulf of Aden. And then it occurred to me that all the rushing of all these ships to the coast of Somalia to deal with these, it's really odd. These puny little speedboats with these guys racing up to tankers and hijacking them doesn't seem to me to merit the sending of the vessels, the vast number of vessels that are being sent into the area. And I was thinking that would be the perfect cover story to flood, flood the area with the military hardware that they need. And it's starting to occur to me that I've heard that this ongoing galactic war has been going on, is coming to a head with several rival alien alliances vying for dominance of the Earth and its resources, which includes the water and us, the people. And I really wonder if this whole thing about this war with Iran itself could be a cover story to kind of make more mundane this war that is actually a higher level war on a galactic level. And the opening of this stargate off the Gulf of Aden and the description of that McCollum gave of the verticular nature of this, the effect that it's having on the ocean and the upwelling and the whirlpool. Just by chance, I was listening to that interview and then switched over to your interview with John Hutchinson, and he described that in his work with electromagnetic vortices, the electromagnetogravitic work that he's doing, that he's got a videotape of water swirling around and all of a sudden levitating. Mm-hmm. I said, my God, John Hutchinson's a genius. And it seems like his technology, this thing that he's been dabbling with for, studying for all these years, may be the same technology that's opening up that portal over the Gulf of Aden, based on the description given by Aaron McCollum.
Okay. Now, let me ask you, if it is that technology, that would mean that the so-called black world has it and has it fairly perfected, or it would mean that some alien species has it and is using it. Which way is it? Who's fooling around in the Gulf? Is it us or them?
My impression would be that it's them coming through and that the powers that be are standing a guard there, waiting in anticipation to see what else comes out of that that vortex. That's my impression of it.
Do you think that these warships from all these nations have the equipment that it would take to take on something that comes through that portal?
I doubt it. Other than the Anglo-American Alliance, I don't think that anybody else has the technology to deal with that. Now, here's another interesting idea. If this description is correct, all things being intertwined, all terrestrial forces being interrelated, It occurs to me that if there is this powerful force operating in the Gulf of Aden, lifting the ocean up and down in particular whirlpools, isn't that itself going to have an effect on the center of the Earth and the center of gravity? And could it be that that action there is precipitating these earthquakes on the opposite side of the world?
Well, it could be. It could be.
There is this element. See, there's this thing. It's hard for people to comprehend this if you're a flatlander, you know, a flatland thinker.
Yeah.
Like a three dimensions only, and Earth is flat, or streets are flat, nothing's flat. Space-time is round, space-time is curved. And this there's a certain kind of physics that is called hyperdimensional physics, which studies the internal energy states of rotating masses. And if you study the work of Richard Hoagland, you'll see that basically geometrically these vortices, the spinning of the planet creates vorticular motion inside the Earth that creates great pressures, and these great pressures seem to seek out the path of least resistance. And the path of least resistance, as these upwellings are rising from the center of the Earth upward, seem to have a preference for coming out at points that would form a tetrahedron. A tetrahedron is not a pyramid. A pyramid has a square base and four triangular sides. A tetrahedron has four triangular sides, all of equal dimensions. So if you take a tetrahedron and visualize this tetrahedron being placed inside the Earth so that one point touches the North Pole, the bases of the tetrahedron will touch the Earth at plus and minus 19.5 degrees of the relative to the equator. So the geometry of this hyperdimensional physics, if you want to visualize it in terms of objects, visualize a sphere with one triangle, or let's call it a triangle for the moment, but one tetrahedron with a point on the North Pole, another tetrahedron with a point on the South Pole. The bases of these tetrahedrons would interlace, and they would touch the Earth at 19.5 degrees north and south of the equator. And this happens to be where we have the most powerful upwellings of telluric Earth energy on the planet, including the Hawaiian Islands. We have the Bermuda Triangle. We have the area of the Canary Islands where this amazing volcano, La Cumbre, exists. And so these are the areas where these energies upwell most powerfully. And people who are, as I said, I'm sorry, but flatland thinkers, people who think the universe works like a billiard table, are forgetting, some very important points. The billiard table is not flat. It's curved, too.
Well, that, you know, that's interesting. You know, it is true that physicists and astronomers and various other types of scientists have told us that time-space is curved. But I had this conversation with a physicist on the telephone just yesterday. Mm-hmm. And this conversation goes like this. Since they say it's curved, why are all the equations linear? All the equations having to do with physics and having to do with, for instance, Einstein's theory of relativity and all of his writing about what if you could run along beside a beam of light at the speed of light, what would that be like? Well, look, all the equations are linear equations. Now, for Tesla, everything was about frequency.
Right.
For Einstein, it was about velocity and mass. What if neither one of them is accurate, but both of them are accurate together? Because if you have a wave and that wave is running at the speed of light, whatever kind of wave it is, it's running at the speed of light. Mm-hmm. It necessarily, because it's a wave, it is frequency, and it is emanating harmonic frequencies in a 360 degree by 360 degree sphere around it.
Yes, sir. You're right on target, man.
Now you cannot use linear equations to describe the speed of light. Now, hang on to your hat. Listen to this. If you're running at the speed of light, then you possibly can see your reflection. If you exceed the speed of light, even by a particle, there is no light because you've outrun your reflection.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore,
you become light. If you reach the speed of light, you become light.
Yeah, but when you exceed the speed of... But no, when you exceed the speed of light, you become dark.
Oh, yeah, you'll be in the dark.
When you exceed the speed of...
Up with you.
Your reflection...
Well, who really knows? I won't hazard a guess as to what that looks like.
Well, let me take it one more step and then get your comment on this. That means then, and the scientists tell us, that the expansion of the universe is happening at faster than the speed of light. And the way they know this is because if it were not happening faster than the speed of light, then they would be getting reflections back from the edge of the universe. And they're not getting reflections back from the edge of the universe, so the edge is moving out faster than light. Therefore, if you exceed the speed of light, you have achieved the speed of dark, which is faster than light.
That's right. Now, we've seen that on people send that very, very witty, you know, if 186,000 miles per second is the speed of light, what is the speed of dark? And people thought, oh, that's a joke. It's not a joke.
No, it has to have a speed.
I would recommend to our listeners, there's a very interesting and short interview with Jack Sarfatti.
Mm-hmm.
He's a physicist, and he was on that show that we talked about before, but on YouTube. He gave a pre-interview interview, and he has some remarkable insights and things to say. And one of them is this, that dark matter is drawing light matter toward a conclusion. That's a fantastic idea, because most of us think about the universe exploding from the Big Bang and being pushed to it. The concept of dark matter is that this mass of dark matter is actually yanking all other real light matter, let's call it the visible universe, light matter,
mm-hmm.
including the energy in it, that this dark matter is drawing it, yanking it, pulling it toward, may I say, a foregone conclusion, something that's like a concept, an idea. And he draws on the work and the philosophy of Teilhard de Chardin, who was a famous Jesuit scientist,
mm-hmm.
who tried to reconcile science with Christianity. And I think he came pretty close. And he came so close that the Catholic Church became very upset with him and tried to get rid of him and sent him off to Outer Mongolia on an expedition where they thought, okay, we're rid of him. Lo and behold, he's on the expedition that goes to Mongolia and finds the Peking Man, which at that time was the oldest human fossil on Earth. And Dr. Sarfatti, uses this concept of the Omega point. So the Alpha point being the Big Bang.
Hang on, Robert. Caller, if you'll hang on, we'll get to you in just a moment. All right, Robert, go ahead.
All the energy that came out of the Alpha point toward this culmination, and that we are in for one big ride, and that this may be what we're going through right now. So I recommend looking, YouTube, Dr. Jack Sarfatti, Sarfatti. Fascinating little snippet.
All right, let's go to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Hello, caller.
Hello, Kevin. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we hear you fine.
Something happened. I'm not hearing you talk right now.
Okay.
We're listening.
Yep, we're listening. The telephones are open, and the telephone number is 623-444-5889. Or toll free at 888-223-4599. All right, let me give them to you again. The main number, 623-444.
Kevin, if I may interject.
5889, or the toll free number at 888-223-4599.
Whisper, I'm having to cover my ear to hear you.
Okay, let's go back to the telephone caller. You're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where you're calling.
Kevin, something's happened to the phone line. I was hearing you real good, but now I'm not hearing you too well. You're being muffled.
We can hear you. Go ahead.
Right. I can hear you, Robert. This is Mike from Kentucky. Hello to both of you.
Hello, Mike. Good to hear from you.
All right, I have a little story based on what you were just saying I'd like to share with you. It'll take me a minute. Back in 1971, I was sitting in a screen of consciousness demonstration in Miami Beach, Florida. The lecturer was telling about your mind being a screen, and it's sort of like a blackboard. So I saw myself pushing on it, and the next thing you know, instead of being static, it was spongy, and I was traveling through this blackboard. It's sort of like I was in a tunnel at a great, very great speed, and I always saw this light ahead of me, and nothing but a light. All of a sudden, the light ceased, and I found myself in a totally black or lightless space. Well, there, when I first got there, it kind of disturbed me, but I thought, well, I'm all alone. Then I felt like I was part of everything. I thought I was cold, I was warm. It was just every negative thought that I would have was replaced, and I would have liked to have stayed there, but unfortunately, I couldn't. But it's like you said, you go past that speed of light, and apparently this is what happened to me, because then later as I watched this experience, I saw fingers of light back into my attention, and I focused on them, and I was right back in my room. That's my story.
Well, I've been through that same tunnel, and it's a very common description of this passageway, let us say, that when you successfully separate your mind-soul, and this again relating to remote viewing to make it more intelligible to the audience, that in the passage of the conscious mind soul out of the body, there is this transit zone involving this tunnel, and you feel like you're being accelerated through this circular black tunnel, and there is this incredibly brilliant light at the other side. And when you pop through the other side, you may encounter extraterrestrials. You may encounter relatives, loved ones who died and may appear to you. It is kind of like a near-death experience, Mike, in that you weren't dying, but people who do die and come back describe going through the same tunnel that you've described going through in life. And I will attest to it that I've experienced the passage through that tunnel many times during my life. And interestingly enough, one of the first times that I popped through that tunnel occurred about 2 years after my Tai Chi master had died. And when I popped through that tunnel, what I saw was arms rising in front of me doing Tai Chi. But they weren't my hands, they were my Tai Chi teacher's, my Tai Chi master's hands. And the feeling that went through my body and my mind was, I can do Tai Chi again. Meaning that he was experiencing or channeling his wisdom, his knowledge, his movement, but using me as a vehicle. And so, you know, perhaps going back to what we said earlier, perhaps the dolphin in the pool with the human is facilitating the jump through, and maybe hand-holding, you know, that we call it, hand, you know, like you're scared to go someplace, and like somebody goes with you just to see that they check you out. Perhaps the dolphin is, in that case that I was referring to, is acting as a guardian as well as a guide. So if people, you know, are interested in remote viewing, I recommend Journeys Out of the Body by Robert A. Monroe. That is my textbook for teaching, because I do teach people how to develop this skill. And Robert A. Monroe's book, which I came across first in around 1972, was a godsend, because I was already developing these skills coming out of, you know, the artificial intelligence program at Fordham and carving my own way into parapsychology. This book dropped into my lap. I saved it from being burned, actually. I saw a big stack of books that are going to be thrown in a furnace, and I saw Robert Monroe's book. It's available on the internet in a PDF form, and I highly recommend it to anyone who's interested in this subject. And he will describe the same thing, passing through that tunnel.
I studied the course, and I know the exercise is available in that. So thanks again, Robert. Appreciate it. And Kevin, thank you. And I hope, I don't know what's wrong with your mic, but...
not a thing. Not
it's
one.
Coming back. It's coming back. It's good.
There's not a single thing wrong with this equipment. That's interference out there between you and me somewhere.
It's just muffled to me. I can't really hear you.
Sorry about that.
I can hear you. It's much better than it was before. Robert Monroe. But, you know, there's another book. I don't know, it's a little more esoteric, but it's called The Tibetan Book of the Dead by W. Evans Wentz. This man translated this ancient book of Tibetan. It's a guide for human beings to prepare for that day when we do make that the quantum leap to the other side of life. And it's quite a description of...
Okay, Robert, we'll have to hear about that when we come back. We're into a break, and we shall return, folks. Don't go away.
Oh,
Most of the great music you hear right here on Steel Eye Media Network is supplied by the independent artists from GarageBand.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to GarageBand.com, look it up, download it. You can even buy the group's CDs, in many cases, right there at GarageBand.com.
And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Robert, let's go to the telephone line. And caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, this is John from Vancouver Island.
Hi, John.
Hi, John.
I kind of missed the first hour, but you were talking about dolphins?
Yes, I was.
And that's what kind of twigged me, because dolphins, if they were looking up out through the surface of the water, I kind of put that together with the idea of the redshift. It got me thinking that the redshift is very much like, you know, looking up between mediums. So if we were in some kind of medium and there was some kind of energy coming in, you would get a refraction, which could be like a redshift.
Do you mean coming in toward you? If it's coming in toward you, it's going to be a blue shift. Because the way that works, if it's racing away from you, a light is racing away from you close to the speed of light, it's kind of stretching out. And as it stretches out, that's what it's going toward. The red is what you're going to perceive. But if it's racing toward you close to the speed of light, the light is being compressed, and so you would see more something like what they call a blue shift. All of this is, part of relativity. But what is the point about the dolphins?
How do I put this? I just got this notion that the whole redshift thing could be because we're in a particular kind of medium, which might be like being in water.
Yes, you're talking about the ether.
Fair enough.
They said there was no ether, and all of a sudden we're coming back and like, oh, maybe there is an ether. You know?
Yeah.
That's the medium.
Well, I understand
what you're saying.
Okay. I'm also relating it to the idea in quantum mechanics where. In perception, the field collapses upon perception. So if you're talking about as far as we can see throughout the entire universe, that would represent some kind of collapse of a quantum field. No matter how far we can look out, that's as much as we can see, and so that would represent some type of quantum collapse of the field.
Yes, and it's also looking into the past, because we're not seeing the present. We're seeing.
Well, you see, I'm not so sure about that.
I've thought about that a long time. Which way you're looking?
Mm-hmm. We're riding a light cone, basically. Yeah. Well, it could be the future slowing down into the present. It could be that much.
Do you know about the light cone, the theory of the light cone? Okay, there's a theory
that our perceptions are
allowing us to see just one slice of a continuum, you know, and that reality unfolds kind of like a movie, and there's like separate time frame. This time frame dissolves, and the next time frame comes in. And I think I've mentioned this before on Kevin's show, that in working with Einstein's equation, I've come to the conclusion that we live in an intermittent universe, that we're on, we're off, we're on, we're off, and that Einstein's equation reveals that we are flickering from being into non-being at about 1.5 trillion cycles per second.
That's pretty fast.
it's kind of fast, so that's why you don't perceive it happening, except you say something changed. But the thing is that when we're off, like this is a binary universe, this idea of the intermittent universe, this idea allows the presence of other beings to cohabitate this space that we're in. The only thing is that we can't both be here at the same time. So this whole thing about grays coming through portals and, you know, opening walls in space and stepping in and stepping out, maybe they found a window through this space-time membrane. And it's that when we're here, everything consolidates, solidifies, and then instantly dissolves, allowing the possibility of change. In that space where we are in an immaterial space, chance and chaos come into play. And this is very important, because if you try to follow the rationale of physicists, they're trying to predict the future according to scientific laws. And they're trying to reduce it to a billiard ball kind of concatenation of effects. But the fact that when we're in that other state, the non-being state, in between the two, the flickers, two things exist, chaos and chance. And those two things are what allow freedom, liberty, and not just the domino theory of things cascading mechanically in creation. So in that time, that's when a human being with free will can assert a choice. Because of chaos and chance, it allows change to be directed. Otherwise, the universe would just unfold like in a cascade of events that are mechanical, just like those domino strings that you see when people set them up and hit one domino and it's all predictable. It's always going to happen. Einstein said God does not play dice with the universe. Well, I think he does, and because he put chance and chaos into the mix to make things interesting and to make free will possible. That's what I have to say. By the way, I'd like to say this to you. I like the fact that you have the faculty to dwell on such things, that you are willing to explore in your own mind theories as you were expressing them. And I feel that this is very important, whether your idea is right or wrong. I admire the fact that you're willing to try to explore it on your own, because flatland physics is trying to force us into one view of the universe. And Kevin was asking me why they're trying to express curved space-time concepts in linear equations, and it's because they're trying to force true flatness and flatland thinking. And I keep referring to flatland because I want the readers to perhaps look on the internet for a book called Flatland by Edwin Abbott. I was required to read this in my first year of high school in my geometry class, and it changed my life forever. It's about a world called Flatland that's inhabited by geometric beings, a point, a line, a triangle, squares, trapezoids, circles, but they only live on this two-dimensional world, and something happens where one of the denizens of this world, he's taken up off of Flatland, and he looks down on Flatland, and he sees circles, triangles, lines, trapezoids, as I said, and he has this expansion of consciousness. Because then he goes back down into Flatland, and he tries to tell the Flatlanders about the true nature of their reality, because Flatlanders perceive each other, or I should say misperceive each other, because they only can see one dimension of each other. So a circle is perceived as a line that kind of fades out at the ends, and a line is perceived as a line, but that can swivel and turn into a point, and so on. It's a fascinating book, and it's really an analog or an analogy of what happens to people who, perchance, have an encounter with UFOs. It alters their consciousness, it raises it to another level of awareness, and then they have to come back down here into Flatland and try. It's like, man, I saw a UFO, I swear, it was an extraterrestrial. And who can believe that, you know, or who could believe that? But it has happened so often that now we are starting to get an idea that this is a constant state of affairs in our reality.
Well, you know, I heard an astronaut commenting, this was several years ago, but commenting that it's very, very difficult when someone asks you, well, what does it feel like to be in space? Mm-hmm. And his answer was, it feels like you're in space. Mm-hmm. And he said, how can I describe what that feels like to someone who's never felt it?
Right. It's similar to the paradox or the problem of this point in Flatland who was elevated to higher consciousness. And of course he goes back to Flatland and he becomes antisocial because he's trying to alter the order, the law and order of Flatland, which is this is the way things are. There's only two dimensions and it's an aberration to believe the three dimension exists. Edwin Abbott. Marvelous.
Sounds interesting. Yeah. All right, let's go to the phone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, hi guys, this is Ryan.
Hi.
Washington.
How you doing, Ryan?
Good.
Good.
Yeah, if there's anybody that has a child that is autistic or suffers from mental disorders, let them play around with a dolphin or let them frolic around in the water with the dolphin. There's been a lot of studies that severely autistic children, after spending a lot of time with dolphin, they come out of a sort of a... So some of them are vastly improved after doing that, but I guess the reason why I called, I guess there's two points. The reason why I called was... when the Earth passes through the center of the Milky Way, there's something known as the Dark Rift, which is supposed to be a disturbance in, I think it's some, I'm not a physicist, so I'm just asking, do you think that is it a gravity weld or something that is in the center that, do you think that might have something to do with some of these earthquakes?
Yes.
That are going on?
Kevin, you want to take that? Do you know what he's referring to?
Well, I do. When we line up with the... when we pass through what basically I guess we could call the equator of the galaxy, so that we're directly in line with the center of the galaxy. We're not looking up at the Milky Way, nor can we look down at it. We're right in the middle. And so there is this, what they call the Dark Rift. There are people who say, and they may be right, that at the center of our galaxy is a black hole. That much they've determined. There is a supermassive black hole at the center of the Milky Way and at the center of most galaxies. But when we're in alignment with that, so that we're not above or below that, we're right at its equator. There are people that say that, yes, there will be more gravity waves hitting us than we normally would have. So I don't know. Does that answer your question, Ryan? Well, he's gone. Okay.
Well, I understand his question. And in terms of this... this phenomenon of lining up with the galactic center.
Well, we got caught by the break again. Caller, are you willing to hang on through the break?
Sure.
All right, you hang in there. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Thank you. right, we are back. We are on Final Approach. Robert, I want you to have a chance to finish your thought about lining up with the galactic medium. And, caller, you hang in there, and we'll get to you in just a second.
Okay, I'll make this brief. The idea is that the black hole is spinning and drawing in all of this matter, and it's also ejecting it. That there are the two beams. Think of it like a pole through a vortex. And that it's radiating energy, that there's a beam. There's one on the axis, but there's also this radiating field coming out along the equator. And as the Earth is sinking through space-time, it's going to come to a point where it's going to align with that the ecliptic, basically, of the galaxy. And at that point is going to be exposed to a torrent of energy, gravitational forces, which will have an effect on every particle of matter and every atom on the Earth. What the effect will be, we cannot say. A lot of theories on that, but basically that's what the idea is about alignment with the galactic center.
All right. Caller, your first name and where are you calling from?
Yeah, it's Kevin from North Bay, Ontario.
Hi, Kevin.
Hello there.
Hi,
hello
Kevin.
There, Mr. Morning. Hello, Robert.
Hello. Hi, Robert.
Yes.
Fine.
Can you hear me, guys?
Yes.
Okay, good. Yeah, you know, you were talking about earlier about how they put these Bigfoots and other things in these movies, and that just may, in fact, you know what phrase comes to mind when I hear that? Hidden
what?
In plain sight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep.
Yep.
Well, they want to acclimatize us.
Yeah.
They want to get us used to something like that.
That, and also, I've always said that the best way to discredit anything is to put it into fiction.
In some ways, perhaps.
Yeah.
But sometimes that might spur more belief in it than if it's really well done.
True.
Like Close Encounters was pure fiction. Close Encounters of the Third Kind was pure fiction in 1977, but it didn't really discredit the whole field. It actually brought more attention and more credibility to it.
Yeah, but I also heard of when people like to talk about this whole New World Order thing. I remember in the mid-90s when Mr. Ted Turner put it into a fictional setting, people said, well, you watch too much pro wrestling, or when you talk about other things like alien abductions, or when you talk about high-tech sci-fi technology, that that some of the secret technology that the U.S. military and other militaries do have, people say, well, you watch too many movies.
Yeah.
You know, it
well, but look, you expect mushrooms to be mushrooms.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of the times the mainstream media movies tend to spread the spores, so to say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, you know, they're really constrained. The mainstream media has to adhere to certain policies, and the sword of Damocles over the media's head is that if they deviate from the dictates of these policies of what is forbidden territory, you know. At the end of each year, their license has to be renewed by the FCC. And if they're out of line, you know, that's where they have the headaches, you know. So
yeah.
The government has a very powerful instrument to force the mass media, broadcast media, and keep them towing the line.
Well, and of course, we have a free press. I choked when I said that. Okay, Kevin, thanks for the call.
Yeah. To go back, I know we have just a few minutes, but mm-hmm. I wanted to touch on this this idea. I'm going to make a bold statement. Einstein lied, okay? He held back a lot. He misled us. He said, and I had this very interesting meeting with Professor Michio Kaku, one of the most brilliant of modern-day scientists, who's produced a fine book on future technologies and the human potential, basically. But I asked him a question I've asked others, and he was quite shocked by it. And the question was this: Professor, do you not think that it's a non sequitur for Einstein to have set a limit on our ability to travel at the speed of light, to say that it's impossible to travel faster than the speed of light, when his equation, in fact, he has a factor that attest to something greater than the speed of light? And he said, what? I said, don't you think it's a non sequitur, means illogical? For him to have set a limit of the speed of light for us to travel through the universe when his equation posits a value of c squared, how can we not travel faster than the speed of light when his equation posits a factor in E equals mc squared that says that the energy released is c squared, which is 186,000 miles per second times 186,000 miles per second,
mm-hmm.
which is quite a high figure. And he was so shocked, and he said to me, we have found no exceptions to Einstein's theory of relativity. He got very dogmatic. I mean, what do you say to a question like that? No, nobody.
Well, I said something similar to him. I said the speed of light cannot possibly be the fastest speed there is. It is the fastest speed we have observed.
That's right. But you know what is faster than the speed of light?
Yeah, the speed of dark.
The speed of time, and time is in the. And I'm not joking. The equation reveals that before light can enter space, that space has to be prepared by the advent of a wave of time. Time has to change space-time to allow light to pass into this new space. Now, Einstein hinted that this thing existed. He called it the Gespensterfeld. And that means the ghost field. And he hypothesized something called needle radiation. And the idea was in his mind at the time, but he disavowed it. But I think that he disavowed it under pressure. He didn't want to go there, basically. But basically, the original theory was that for every photon of light that's passing through the universe, there is a pilot particle leading it, guiding it. If I may make the analogy, when ocean liners come into New York City, they have to be led into the bay and through safe waters to their concourse where they're going to dock. And the pilot has to go out there and lead it. So it's this little boat that leads the big boat in. So this pilot particle is a fascinating idea, because it has to travel faster. It's got to be on the nose of the photon to lead the photon through this space-time, but he backed off on that, and I believe that that's where part of his cover-up is. You know, like I say, Einstein lied. And,
here's another thing. Recently,
they paint him to be.
Recently, scientists have published a paper stating that they have observed pole changes, magnetic pole changes, in a pulsar that are occurring at six times the speed of light.
Well, that is fascinating. I hadn't heard that. That's pretty rapid.
That's within the last month. That paper has been published.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I can only imagine what the electro magnetogravitic forces in the region of that pulsar must be like. The space-time just must be warped.
It's got to be intense. But there you go. Nothing can go faster than the speed of light. That does. Mm-hmm. Six times the speed of light.
Yeah.
And the speed of light is only the fastest speed that we had observed. How could you observe something going faster than its reflection? You couldn't.
Yeah. Well, this is the fascinating thing about dark matter and the way Dr. Sarfati expressed it, that dark matter is drawing light matter toward, it's almost as if saying that there is an intention.
Well, I hate to say it, but we have reached the end of the show, and the music's taking over. It's going to kick us both off the air here. Robert, thank you for being with me. Stay on the line for just a moment. Folks, I hope you enjoyed it, and that's a wrap for this evening. I had said Stuart Swerdlow would be with us this evening, and I spoke wrong. It's tomorrow evening, and I hope you'll join us for that. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do, too. You can call me whatever you wish to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.